Okay, the subject for the talk, the two horses called faith and wisdom. And in the last few years, the word mindfulness, and mindfulness as a kind of concept, has become an icon. It's become, in a way, synonymous or mixed with Dharma in the eyes of the Western world. And so mindfulness has become a thing that is taught in colleges, to psychologists. There's mindfulness practice in hospitals. There is mindfulness in pain clinics. And then gradually, Dharma practice is known as mindfulness practice. And the attachment to simplify this great teaching is quite strong. So it's easier for people to handle mindfulness, as that's what everyone does in the Dharma. It kind of makes it easier to understand. So mindfulness, in a way, has, to some extent, taken over in the popular mind as a label for Dharma. And it's not because mindfulness is not important. Mindfulness is very important. It is a major primary tool for our practice. It is what we're doing here. It is leading us, especially if we understand mindfulness as expansion of our power of knowing, our power of awareness. Mindfulness has in it awareness, it has in it remembering to come back to the now. It has in it presence. It is important. But it is only one of a group of powers in us which we bring to our spiritual life and our spiritual journey. And the Buddha spoke of five powers. And why I wanted to talk about two other powers besides mindfulness is simply that I read a few days ago in a book by Aya Khema a nice description of these five powers. And she said these are like five horses that draw the carriage. The lead horse, the first horse, is mindfulness, because that really directs where we're going. Without mindfulness, we don't move. We're in ordinary, distracted habit mind. But mindfulness may be the first horse, but the two horses behind are faith, or trust, and wisdom. And the two horses behind that are concentration and energy or effort. So these are the five powers, bala, five powers that the Buddha talked about, which are engines that drive our spiritual life. So I want to really concentrate on the two pair of horses behind mindfulness. That mindfulness directs, is opening our awareness, our ability to know, to see, to perceive, to be conscious, to wake up. But it needs other engines to turn the awareness into spiritual life. And the next two horses are the trust. and wisdom. So I want to start by just sharing a contemplation with you, that we are born with, I would say, primal insecurity. We are born from the need to survive. We are born with a mind that is struggling to survive. We are born into a world that is, in a way, trying to take us to pieces again. The whole universe is needed to create a being, with all the molecules, the consciousness, the everything put together, and you have a human being, you, me. And in a way, it's hard work to keep it together, this human being. And there's a tendency for it to go back into the molecules and into the universe again, right? And we have to fight to hold it together. So we need food every few minutes. We need a cup of coffee every other minute. We need love. We need appreciation and respect. We need pleasure. We need to have things. We need houses. We need a bank account. We need a car. We need no conflict with our parents and our partners and our we need, you know, endless conditions to keep this thing called a human being together. And in the end, it doesn't, it goes to pieces. Whatever you want to do, however hard you work, it's here for a very short time, and then it goes back to where it came from. And aging, actually, I have my doctorate many, many years ago was in the biochemistry of aging. And I worked on aging, hizdaknut. And it was very clear that the aging process is about all the mistakes in the body and all the disintegrations and all the chaos eventually winning. And the effort we put, the energy we put to hold it together, we just cannot anymore. That's aging. So we're born with primal insecurity. In a way, it drives us. It drives attachment. It drives need. It drives us to be somebody. It drives us to want. It drives us to be a self, this insecurity. What is a self? Why do we need a self? It's a kind of mechanism to hold all of us together against the problems of life that wants to put us to pieces again. The self is a kind of like a boss that's holding, like a mufaked, a officer that's controlling the army and making sure it's all in place and it's all busy with survival. So in a sense, the self and everything the self is doing, such as a lot of thinking, a lot of planning, what is going to be the problems arising? Where does thinking come from? 90% of the thinking is about surviving. It's about what I need to think about so as to be better in the next 5 minutes. What I need to think about so that it will be better for me, or that so I will survive, or I will exist. That's most of thinking. Trying to work out the future. What will be? Trying to work out what's better. Trying to replay scenarios all the time. Tasritim. That's most of thinking. Turning the scripts, writing the scripts, so as to be more comfortable in the future, in the next 5 minutes. So all of that, a lot of activity, and never mind wars and conflicts and so on, is about primal insecurity. But we were also born with primal trust. And you just have to think of the baby at the breast. There is complete trust. unless there's problems with the milk, and then you, primal insecurity comes up, and the baby cries, and the mother gets frustrated, and blah, it all goes to pieces, this beautiful trust, but insecurity arrives. But there is trust. There is beautiful trust that we're born with also. Otherwise, we couldn't live. We wouldn't be able to survive. We just couldn't. We couldn't live. The trust is, and the non-trust or the primal insecurity are held together. They're a duality. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter called Lisa, and she's a real brilliant little being. And I was telling the story to Christopher and to Michal yesterday. She was with my wife at the garage, and our car was being mended, and she was sitting in a chair in the garage watching this guy mending the car. And there were two other kids running around, older kids, making a lot of noise, and the garage, the guy, the musachnik, the garage man, he took a piece of rubber or something and threw it at the children. Well, it missed them and hit her. Well, not any, no damage done. But she was so shocked. And she had never seen such an action by an adult before. She couldn't understand. She felt so offended and shocked. What?
She lived in Israel?
Yes, but she's 2 years old. She'd never seen such a thing before. She was shocked. And she started to cry and cry and cry and cry. And the garage man was very apologetic, and he ran with a chocolate and gave it to her. And she stopped crying for a minute and looked at him and said, "Will this help?" Zell there. Amazing. And he had to say no. But I think in this little story, first of all, there is a lot, it tells us a lot about trust, that she did have trust. The trust was broken, so there is in there fear and non-trust. And there is wisdom. There was a moment of wisdom there. What is the antidote for trust? What are you trying to tell me? This chocolate is going to solve existential reality problem. And so our trust is part of our belonging to the world. We are born into the world and we still belong to the world. And the insecurity that we feel, even as a child, is a kind of withdrawal from the world into the self to protect me and make sure I stay alive. I need from the world food, as I said. It's a withdrawal. So the withdrawal from the world is like based on insecurity, and the joining of with the world is the trust. And the two are in dynamic. The joining of the world, the baby at the breast, or the love that we feel for each other, or for the simplicity and connection that we feel, every child is expressing. That's why children are so wonderful for us, because they express the trust and the joy, the freedom and the joining of the world. They're not locked into insecurity, but there is insecurity there from the first moment. So the two are in balance. In our spiritual life, trust is a power. The most gross example of this that just jumps to mind when Christopher was talking about Asa, I somehow had an association of all the thousands of young Israelis with their little orange tails coming out of their bags, going off to Asa to stop the Hitnatkut. And what an energy from all over the country. The young people were really, and I felt there so much power that young people would just go and hitchhike and take their bag on their back with a little orange tail sticking out. And what a kind of power of belief. And this is power. This is, people will die for it. People, Orthodox Jews would die rather than break Shabbat. Buddhists also, who are deeply into the Buddhist belief system, would die and did. Time of Vietnam, would kill themselves. Belief is a huge power. Ani Mamin is a huge power. And in a way, belief in the Buddha is a power that we can tap into, we can touch. However, belief by itself is a very dangerous and extreme power. Belief lacks the wisdom. Even if we believe in the Buddha, we believe in the Buddha's enlightenment, we put a golden statue of the Buddha in front of us, we pray to the Buddha every day, there's a big power in that. But there is something that we lose. And we lose a certain freedom. We lose a certain awareness. We lose a balance. We, in a way, sell our consciousness to the object of belief. Whether it's a god or a Buddha, we sell it, we donate it, our consciousness, and we get back power. So there's something very difficult about belief. But nevertheless, if you look at the text, the Buddha is always encouraging at the beginning of the practice. When people come to him, he does encourage. He says, trust me. He says, you can have faith in the Buddha. But faith in the teachings, not in the person. And the Buddha did encourage a kind of soft belief, which I would call the power of faith. And it is not a bad thing to have the power of faith. Because we need to find power where we can. It is not easy for us to just to find the determination, to find the energy to practice, to really keep going. It's not easy for us. And faith, which is, I would say, light belief, which is belief that doesn't ask us to sell all our awareness to the God or to the whatever, mitnachalim, or to the Buddha. It doesn't ask us that. Faith is, in a way, soft belief, more quiet belief. And there is a power of I would say allowing it to take us. Faith gives motivation. Faith gives us power when we are weak. Faith gives us power when we feel despaired, when we can't do this anymore, when there isn't fruit of practice that we can see, when we're back into the kind of main street of ordinary life and we feel that we got taken over, when our practice disappears and we don't know if we have it or we don't have it, when we're alone in our flat, in our urban cave somewhere in Ramat Gan or Afula or Kleel, no difference. And we're alone and we don't know what all of this is about. And we don't have proof or in our hand a spiritual path. It feels like it's gone. In these moments, and in all other moments actually, the faith is a power that we need. So the Buddha specially talked about it at the beginning of the road. When things are still shaky, at the beginning of our practice, we haven't practiced for years and years and years, and we think, oh, I need to practice. But then, what is it for us? It can be light. It can be too light. And faith is something which is the ground on which will help us. I once heard a teacher being asked, someone asked the teacher, I get up in the morning, I practice a bit of Vipassana, then I do a little bit of Kabbalah, then I do some Qigong, after that I light a candle and do some yoga practice, then, you know, he gave a long list from about every possible spiritual new age path that you can think of, and then said to the teacher, is that all right? And the teacher had no way of answering this hugely complicated collection of practices from every spiritual, you know, every page of Chaim Achirim was there. But the teacher just simply said, it doesn't in the end matter what you do, but practice as if your life depends on it. And it's, thanks. And it's that kind of sense of taking it seriously that the faith gives us. In the Buddhist language, the faith is described as a refuge, which is a very nice way to describe it. A refuge, miklat, miflat, a home, a sense of being covered, a sense of being held. It's a very nice way of describing faith. It is not the same as belief. It's a sense of being held. And I've talked to many religious people who are in Orthodox, in Yadut, about belief in God. And very often you hear the same thing from those that I would think that are less into the belief and into the automat of I believe in God, ani ma'amin be'elohim. In a more deep way, the same, a sense of being held. And it's in a way like that trust of the baby that is being held by the mother. So it is more trust than belief. And the refuges are good for us. And personally, more or less every retreat, I would give the refuges, and more or less every practice of my own, the beginning of every practice, every formal practice, when I sit and do formal practice, I would start with a refuge. And like in the Yadut, you say the Tachata Kanfei Hashchina, under the wings of the Shekhinah. It's like being protected. And why we need this? Because of the primal insecurity with which we're born, with which we're struggling all our life to hold our life together. The survival instinct means we can't do it, especially at the beginning, just with a struggle. We can't be dominated by struggle. We need a refuge. And the refuges are faith, trust. The thing about the refuge, why? I remember the refuge at the beginning of every practice, is because it's active. It's not a belief where you say, I believe in Buddha, and that's it. The trust and the faith is active. It's something that we need to feel in our consciousness and is renewed again and again and again. It is a movement in the consciousness. It is creating another color in our awareness. Tseva acher. When ordinary life paints our consciousness with fear and insecurity and concern and worry and anxiety and thinking too much, it's all painted by insecurity. We can repaint our consciousness with trust. But it needs to be active. And that's why the refuges are more or less the main, if you like, the number one sentence, mishpat, in all Buddhist countries. I was in Sarnath some years ago, and at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you hear 12 or 13 or 14 temples all saying the same thing. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. From every, like the muezzin of the Buddhist muezzinim. from all the temples, the Japanese, the Thai, the Sri Lanka, the Vietnamese, the Burmese, the Chinese, and the Nepalese, the Tibetans, about 10 of them, and all saying the same thing. So it's a key element in Buddhist life is the refuge. And it's as close as we get to, in practice, I'm not talking about a belief here, but a popular folk belief in the golden Buddhas or in the pure land of paradise of the Japanese pure land Buddhism. I'm talking about practice, spiritual life as the Buddha. So as close as we can get to belief is this refuge. I take refuge. I find in the Dharma my refuge. If I look after the Dharma will look after me. If I have faith and trust in the Dharma, it will carry me through. Well, there is an issue here, though. And here is where it gets interesting. The issue is that the Buddhist path is about truth. And it's about the quest for truth. The Buddha, when he experienced and saw, and he had such a shock from seeing the messengers, he came out of his castle, his comfort zone, his castle of comfort, and he saw four messengers. The messengers brought a message of suffering, of difficulty, that life isn't what you think it is. And this propelled him on a quest. And the quest wasn't for belief. The quest wasn't for a teacher to believe in. The quest was for existential truth. And until today, that's what we're doing. The Buddhist path is a path of existential truth, of uncovering truth, of realization, of awakening. It's not a path of belief in. It's a path of awakening, like a path of waking up from sleep, waking up from automatic life, waking up to truth, realization. And liberation. And there is a kind of, in a way, conflict here. How does that fit with faith or trust? Because trust is not about exploring truth. Trust is about refuge, being held. So there's a kind of little duality or conflict or a paradox here. How do they go together? Trust, for example, is a bit artificial to create trust. I talked about repainting the consciousness in a less threatening color. It's active. It's not necessarily opening to the truth. It's actually making truth or making something. And so this is where the wisdom comes in. And this play between trust and wisdom, this dance between trust and wisdom, the two horses that are pulling the carriage, it's really, really interesting. And so I want to talk a few minutes about how they go together, how the two horses ride together. I think, first of all, we already discussed one in which both wisdom and trust go together, and that is the antidote to fear and insecurity in our life, as it comes in our practice retreat. I was just talking yesterday to Marcia about the issue that Christopher raised about conflict in this part of the world, and we were discussing how difficult it is to change deeply the atmosphere of anxiety and fear, the ghetto mind, if you like, that fuels so much conflict in this part of the world, and that how deep it is, and maybe thousands of years deep in Jewish culture of insecurity and fear and lack of trust, bitchoniut, security mindedness, and how much it's a struggle to even introduce trust into that world of bitchoniut. It's such a global consensus. It wraps us everywhere that everyone believes it. It's like emperor's new clothes. You come there with trust. Everyone's believing in security, and you can't even talk about trust because people say, well, what are you talking about? We have enemies everywhere. How can you talk about trust? And you see the same thing again. So trust is an antidote to fear. And the wisdom here is knowing how to feel trust, the power of trust, the use of trust as an antidote to fear. The way trust tells us that the world is not against us. The world is not against us. Trust tells us that. And the wisdom is how to work with that. Recognizing our fears, recognizing wherever we go there is fear or insecurity, and recognizing trust as a healing, as a repair, as a softening, as a sweetening of life, and knowing how the two go together. The dialogue between insecurity and trust, it's a very interesting dialogue. It's with us all the time. And that's where we need a lot of wisdom. The wisdom is in that. But another place where the wisdom and the trust go together, and that's really relevant to our practice, the last words of the Buddha were, be an island to yourself. And in other places, be a light to yourself. Be an island to yourself and practice. And the Buddha encouraged a sense of autonomy. And it's something that we do here when we sit quietly on our cushion with stability, not afraid, taking our place, sitting solid, like a rock, belonging to the world, experiencing our experience and owning our experience, we learn this autonomy. We learn steadiness. We learn trust. And it's good for us to notice it. We come out of this practice with more autonomy, with more steadiness, with more understanding that life is not against us. Part of this autonomy is our ability to go against the stream. We can't go against the stream if we're too afraid. Going against the stream, the Buddha had a number of images for this. It was the story of the monk with a golden bowl, that he threw the golden bowl into the water and said, if the bowl floats against the stream of the river, then I'm going to be okay, I'm going to reach awakening. If it floats down with the stream, I will not. There's something about we need a little bit to go against the stream. I know that all of us feel that at times. When we're with our friends, when we're with our family, when we're with our society, when we open the newspaper, we think, I can't be with this, but it's taking me over. And there's a struggle there with the consensus mind, which is in us, mind of our parents, our school, our society. It's here. It's already, we already internalized it. The kfar bifnim. We go with it. And then along comes the Dharma and said, actually, you go against the stream. There is something there that you have to stand your ground and think differently. And it needs courage, and it needs confidence, and it needs trust. And when we practice going against the stream, we actually build autonomy, we build confidence, and we build a trust. We need it, and we build it. It takes courage to be who we are, to be authentic. It takes courage. We have all the voices in us saying, be like others, do what others do. It takes courage, it takes confidence to be authentically who we are. And the practice of trust, not belief, but trust, is helpful, and is a ground, gives us the ground. And apart from that, any experiences we have, which are not self experiences, which are a bit more open, also need trust. It's actually one of the main places where we main powers which help us experience something a little bit beyond us is trust. Sometimes we can feel we're pushing against all the time a barrier. We want to experience something, or we have a whisper of something, or we there's a barrier, we don't, nothing happens, or we get stuck, or we feel we're practicing, or day after day we sit here, or hour after hour, and nothing moves. Very often, it's an issue of trust. Trust will move. Trust will create, will break through. Trust is experienced as surrender. I let go. I trust the process. I trust the Dharma to do its work. And then something moves. So it's not a problem of more and more and more practice, it's a problem of trust. There's a quote here from Sharon Salzburg. She said, "One of the things that most undermines confidence is not being conscious. When we're not conscious in our lives, we're likely to walk some very old and tired pathways. In that unconsciousness, we walk the same path we walked 1,000 times before. Pathways of judgment, pathways of self-criticism, of doubt, of resistance, of fear. We fall into these states in the moments when we're most unconscious, and then our confidence is undone." I think in those moments we feel like we're betraying those deepest intentions in our lives that are most important to us. And this leaves us feeling fragile and almost unable to trust in ourselves. So the confidence is a key. When I once spoke to Sharon many, many years ago on a retreat, and I asked her, "What do you think is the number one quality that we need for practice?" And she said, "The more and more I think about it, the more I feel that confidence is the one." The confidence, trust. Confidence and trust here are the same. So I want to a little bit address practice. But before that, I want to tell a small story of how this might work in practice. Some time ago, I was working with a woman that had cancer, quite advanced cancer, and she was kind of committed to a spiritual journey. She was committed to practice, to meditation, to awareness. And she was going through a very difficult period. She was taking morphine. She had a lot of pain. The morphine was making her awareness clouded. The pain was in the body. She was alone a lot of the time in a flat. And it had all the ingredients for great difficulty, nothing happening, tragedy, all the parts. And she knew she wouldn't live very long. We began to work on converting everything to practice. Every little thing. What was the experience of morphine? Cloudiness, dreaminess, unclarity. Okay, that's practice. Practice with dreaminess. Practice with unclarity. Practice with cloudiness. Practice with the pleasant feelings of morphine against the pain. Practice with the pain and the morphine up and down the waves of one which is dominant. Practice with the pain. Practice with who am I with this pain? What is my relationship to these moments, which may be a very short, this life? What is my relationship to suffering? What is my relationship to who I am at this moment? I think the main tool that helped her to convert, you know, everybody would say the consensus view is this is impossible to practice in such a situation. It's just difficulty. Like thousands of people going through difficulties of this kind, few of them can do such a thing, convert this to practice. The normal mind would say, oh, it's all too much. It's all too difficult. What changed it in her case is some trust and confidence that she had the power to convert every experience to an experience of awakening. It was only a small thing, but it's a very big thing. It was just that trust. I can do it. At least I can make an effort. At least it's possible for me to try to convert every one of these impossible experiences into an experience of practice, of meeting the truth, of touching what's really happening, of meeting my authentic experience, not what people say, not what everyone cries and disaster and alarm and anxiety, not the consensus, just the authentic moment now. What is it for me now? That confidence was for her a real key. And she had, I would say, 2 years, which were probably the best years of her life, as she said. We need to trust experience and wisdom to see experience as it is. It's not a New Age thing. We don't trust things to be good. A lot of people say, oh, I know what trust is. It's trusting things to work out fine. It's positive thinking. I can trust everything. I trust it'll be okay. That's what trust is. I trust it'll be okay. I can't trust it'll be okay. It will not be okay. Who says it'll be okay? We trust in things to be as they are. That's a difference, if you like. The one difference between Dharma, biggest difference perhaps between Dharma and the New Age, is in the Dharma we trust things to be the way they are, and we know them to be the way they are. And in the New Age we trust things to be better. We trust things that will be all right. They'll be as they are. Painful, pleasant. Painful, pleasant. Okay, not okay. Moment of suffering, moment of joy. But we are bigger than all of that. And that's what the trust gives us. So a couple of points to finish about practicing with trust. In real sense of, as we sit, where is for us the practice of trust? I think the one aspect is to be aware of our autonomy. To feel the confidence that comes from our ability to sit 45 minutes in our place like a rock, unmovable, that will all the consensus and all the blah blah in the world will not move us. All the blah blah in our own mind will not move us. We're here. We're taking our place. We can be healthy, we can be sick, we can be happy, we can be sad, we can feel inside vulnerable, we can feel inside strong. Doesn't matter. Here we are. We sit, we take our place. That gives us that steadiness. Christopher talked about this morning in the instructions. That's steadiness. That's autonomy. And that's practice of trust. We may feel restless. We may be a lot of thinking going on. We may feel anxiety arising. We may have criticism and judgment against ourselves, as Sharon mentioned in this. Where is it for us that we can soften all of that? The judgment, the criticism, the giving up, the all the thinking, blah blah blah, the wheels of thinking going on. It's really a question. There's something in us that can soften all of that. That's trust. We can look for it. We can feel it at times. It's this business of being held. The sense of being held. That life is holding us. The sense of life, in a way, being like we're still at the breast, in a certain way. One Japanese teacher that I met was very fierce. and very powerful little guy. And he's known to be very strict, and people in his monastery sitting there hours and hours, freezing cold, and having real not eating, and so people said to him, "So it's so difficult in your monastery. What do you give?" He said, "It's obvious. The Dharma is mother's milk, chalav em. I give chalav em. I give mother's milk." So in all this, we may go through criticism and judgment and issues and struggle and thinking and restlessness and heaps of pain and so on. But there is a place of softness where we can soften all that with mother's milk. I'm here. I'm born in this world. This is a moment. This is a moment for me where I'm connected with my life. This is my authentic experience. And there's something that is holding me here. That's that faith, that trust. And the other part, which is second part, which is important, is the sense of surrender, is the sense of letting go, and the sense of giving up the struggle. I know that we need some determination. But the determination the determination and the surrender are not in conflict. The determination, the steadiness keeps us here, but the surrender is an inner movement where we give up the struggle. We just let go. We let things happen. We let the Dharma do its work. We trust the process. There is a process going on. We may not experience fireworks, we may not experience ecstasy at this minute. We may not experience this or that, or we may experience difficulty and when we want to experience pleasure. But trust the process. There is a process happening. There is a process happening to us. With the intention and the energy of the group and the teachings that take us, we may not be able to measure how much it's changing us, or we may not be able to measure it. We may not have avnei derech, milestones to say, "Well, this happened, then I go this one and this one and this one." They may not be there for us, but the surrender. Let the process happen to us. Let it just take us. Give it the trust, and that's the other part. And when we're sitting, sometimes struggling with our concentration, with our thoughts, just surrender. Allow it to happen. I'm just here. I give up the struggle. I give up the resistance. I give up the friction. Chikuch. There is a sutta, one of my favorite texts, which I want to finish with. It's called the Sutta of the Logs. And the Sutta of the Logs, the Bule Et. And the Buddha pointed out to, in answer to some questions about progress on the path, he said, "Look at the logs. They float downstream. By themselves, they will reach the ocean if they don't get stuck. They will reach the ocean by themselves. They'll just keep going as long as they don't get stuck. As long as they don't get stuck on..." There were many places where the logs could get stuck, but one of them is this bank, namely me and mine and my issues. The other bank, namely the world, what I want, what I need, what I don't like. Just keeping in the middle of the river, not getting stuck. The logs reach the ocean by themselves. And that's trust. That's trusting the process. That's trusting the Dharma to do its work. That's letting go, surrendering into the process, surrendering into the Dharma, taking refuge in the Dharma. That's what it is. Okay, thank you. So we'll have a few moments of quiet.